is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
It's a major disease in animals that's spread right around the world. And now it has been found in dairy cattle in the United States. I'm talking about bird flu, avian influenza. Yes, dairy cattle, sick dairy cattle across multiple states in the US have tested positive to avian influenza. What does this mean for the spread of that disease? What does it mean to livestock producers in Australia? We'll hear from an expert shortly on just that. We'll also hear from animal welfare experts today on the program who have been giving evidence to the state parliamentary pig welfare inquiry on the research, the science behind how pigs feel and their stress in some of the farming environments as well. Plus power lines and their routes that they will be taking, not only in Gippsland, but in northern and northwest Victoria as well. So they've been modified slightly. We will have a look through those details together. 2467 842 722. If you want to send me a text, I'd love to hear from you.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
An Australian professor says the spread of avian influenza to dairy cattle in the United States should be monitored closely. The United States Department of Agriculture says what's commonly called bird flu has been found in four dairy herds across multiple states in Texas and Kansas. But the risk to humans is low as milk will be destroyed from the sick cattle and sick cattle will not end up in the meat supply chain. Professor Marcel Klaassen from Deakin University studies bird migration and the spread of disease as well. He says it's a development that needs to be watched closely.
A lot of mammals get infected with avian influenza. And that's weird because avian influenza, as the name already implies, that is a virus that infects birds predominantly. But also mammals can get it. Now, for this virus to transmit amongst mammals, it needs to change, it needs to mutate, it needs to evolve further. But it is worrying that more and more mammals are getting affected. And it's all because of this avian influenza virus becoming so widespread. So although the chance of mammals to become infected is small, just because there are so many of these viruses around, more and more different mammal species become infected. And of course, with that, also the chance of that virus to further evolve and mutate and become more and more adapted to infect mammals and also for mammals to infect one another with this, then it's not a bird flu anymore, then it is a mammal flu, obviously. But in origin, it was a bird flu. With this virus becoming more and more widespread, the chances of it also becoming more prevalent in mammals only increases.
Is it particularly interesting that dairy cattle have been found with avian influenza in this case?
Yeah, I think so, because so far most mammal species that got infected, they were predators or scavengers, so they nibble on carcasses that they find and eat it, or they kill animals that are moribund and then ingest this virus, and that's obviously an easy way of attracting a viral infection. So but dairy cats, how do they get it? Well, I'm thinking maybe the drinking water. So on the premises where these cows were found to be infected, indeed they also found wild birds, dead wild birds. So you can imagine a carcass ending up in drinking water, and then that way the cows becoming infected. That is at least, that's my best guess at the moment, how those cows could get infected.
This is where I get slightly nervous, but I feel it's an important next question to ask. If bird flu can find its way into dairy cattle, is that another step in the chain into finding its way into humans at a greater scale?
Well, the USDA claims not, because they obviously test the milk, and they have stepped up the biosecurity, so they test the milk and make sure that milk that is infected, that they take it out of the route to the consumers and destroy it. And then the other thing is the viral load. So it's not that you become infected by just one single virus. Yeah, in principle, that will be possible, but it is, you need to get a fair number of viruses in your system before you truly get infected. Yeah, the risk is only increasing. And that is not just because of dairy cows, but it's just because of this virus becoming so prevalent, because it's really infecting a lot of poultry. So far globally, of this particular strain, 500 million chooks have succumbed, but also millions of wild birds have died because of it. It's just becoming more and more prevalent. And therewith, yeah, it's a numbers game. The chances of such a virus infecting a mammal and also infecting humans is small. But if it is so prevalent, yeah, the chances only increase.
Now that bird flu has found its way into dairy cattle, so pretty big livestock industry as well, away from poultry. Should other areas of livestock be concerned what outbreaks like this could mean for animal health?
Yeah, absolutely. We have to consider that these viruses, notably if they are so prevalent, so I again come to back to it's a numbers game, so that everything can get infected. We saw the same, by the way, in COVID, right? So COVID spread to lots of different animals. So there it started with us, but we are 8 billion people on this globe. So that's a major source. So, but COVID was then found in all kinds of animals. So over the past 25 years, about 1,000 people on this globe have succumbed of avian influenza. So they got infected with a strain of high pathogenic avian influenza and died because of that. So becoming infected again is really difficult. This virus needs to go to a number of mutations to make it really fit for mammals and humans. I cannot stress that enough. So I don't want to cause any panic. It's just that the only thing I want to is make a call for that. We need to do something about this, because ultimately this is only going to get worse.
So I suppose, what do you watch from here as someone who studies it and keeps an eye on a lot of this? What are you keeping an eye on?
Of course, I'm very concerned about the wildlife here in Australia, because they are the ones that are most vulnerable at the moment. So I'm worried about the virus also coming to Australia and how we then respond to it and how it will spread across this continent. I'm also very worried about Antarctica, because it's just made landfall in the Antarctic. And there, of course, you've got huge bird colonies. And I'm just hoping for the best. There's not much we can do, but hoping for the best that it will, the damage will be limited. And now on the longer term, I really hope that we come to our senses and start thinking more longer term on how should we manage our livestock industry. So I don't call for everybody to become a vegetarian or a vegan. We need to be smarter about this. 70% of all birds are poultry at the moment in this globe. If we think about mammals, I think that wildlife in mammals is just a few percent of the biomass on this globe. Most biomass of mammals, that's humans, and is livestock. And we have to realize that there are so-called zoonotic diseases. So there are diseases that can spread between different species of animals. That should be a concern. That should be high on our agenda.
That is Professor Professor Marcel Klassen from Deakin University. He is a professor in ecology at Deakin University, who specializes in bird migration and diseases, ecological issues at the university. He was speaking about his concerns around avian influenza being found in dairy cattle in the United States. The USDA reporting it's found in multiple herds in both Texas and Kansas. Certainly something to watch from here. It is 14 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Let's come a little closer to home right now with a professor from another university. A leading animal welfare expert has given evidence that the Victorian pork industry has a good science-based record at improving animal welfare standards for pigs. University of Melbourne's Animal Welfare Science Centre's Professor Paul Hemsworth gave evidence on the third day of hearings at the Victorian Parliamentary Inquiry into Pig Welfare. We spoke about the early part of that day's hearings yesterday on the Country Hour. You can go and listen to that in the podcast. Professor Hemsworth, though, cited a number of studies into farm practices, such as tail docking, enrichment and farrowing crates versus pens. Here's some of Professor Hemsworth's testimony while he was being questioned by the Nationals' Gail Broad and the Greens' Catherine Copsey.
We've done quite a lot of work, for example, on group housing of sows. And in fact, I think our work on group housing of sows, the space allowance for the space requirements for breeding sows, has probably influenced standards and guidelines around the world. So that was a huge study, two large papers, thousands of animals involved, looking at the effects of floor space on aggression, injuries, stress, reproductive performance, etc. So that is a good example of science that can actually provide industry on information on what is important in terms of not only improving welfare, but also maintaining high reproductive performance in the breeding animal.
Mm. What's your view on the Victorian industry when it comes to pigs? How do we fare compared to the rest of the world?
I think the Australian pig industry is a very innovative industry. The industry is very interested in science. Uptake, I think, is very good in the Australian pig industry. I think the standards that I see, and I don't get around as much as, say, extension people or veterinarians in the industry, but my impression is that the standards are very good compared to, for example, what I've seen in the US and even what I've seen in Europe at times.
I wanted to ask as well around if you've done any work looking at confinement measures. So gestational stalls, we've heard that there's been a really strong move away from those within the industry, and farrowing crates and mating stalls or stalls.
Okay. There's a lot there.
Yes.
We'll start with mating stalls. Yep. We did a study a number of years ago comparing sows that were weaned into groups as compared to sows weaned into stalls. We looked at their stress response early after weaning, and the stress response in the group house sows was certainly elevated compared to those in stalls. And that's probably associated with mixing unfamiliar pigs, which does occur when the sows are removed from their farrowing accommodation and mixed with other pigs, other sows. We also looked at the stress response following insemination after those sows that had been in stalls were then grouped shortly after mating, and those sows that had been in groups and then were put into groups after mating, and there was no difference in their stress physiology. So on that basis, one would say that if you're going to wean sows, if you're interested in reducing the stress response, you probably should wean them into mating stalls.
I'm interested also in the purpose of farrowing stalls, but also the dimensions of farrowing stalls. So one of the things that we've been hearing is around a welfare objective being that pigs are able to stand and stretch and move around or turn around in a stall. What are the factors that lead to really small stalls? Why would that be done?
Well, I think sows have got bigger over time, but there's been quite a lot of work done comparing, firstly, sows in farrowing crates versus unrestrained in pens, with or without enrichment, as well as the effects of those two housing systems. And they can vary a lot. I mean, the farrowing crates will vary in size and et cetera, flooring type. And the farrowing pens will vary in terms of total space, whether or not there's enrichment, etc. It's complicated, but my understanding of the literature, and we've just written a review on this topic, my understanding of the literature is that when you put sows into farrowing crates, there is an acute stress response, but in sows, there doesn't appear to be a difference in the magnitude of the acute stress response as compared to sows going into farrowing pens.
Thank you.
The issue, though, it's more complicated than that. I mean, the issue is piglet mortality in farrowing pens. It is generally higher. the beauty of farrowing crates, now farrowing crates have some disadvantages too, but the beauty of farrowing crates is that it reduces live-born piglet mortality generally. And that, so that's piglets dying in the first few days after birth.
That's Professor Paul Hemsworth from the University of Melbourne's Animal Welfare Science Centre giving evidence to the Parliamentary Inquiry into Pig Welfare in Victoria, which is due to report to Parliament by the end of May. If you want to listen back to a lot of the other evidence that has been given, the country has been covering this extensively while I'm here and whilst I've been away and Angus has been in the chair, Emma Field's been talking you through a lot of that. You can go and listen back to a lot of the evidence from groups like the RSPCA, from pig farmers and from other major companies that have given evidence, all in the Victorian Country Hour podcast feed. Just search for that wherever you get your podcasts. Search Victorian Country Hour. You're listening to the Country Hour. It's 20 past 12 right now. Let's talk about the protection of farmland in this state right now, with the Victorian government saying it is going to further protect farms that operate within 100 kilometres of central Melbourne, banning the building of homes on farmland of smaller size than 40 hectares, and also putting greater protections on what can be built and how farmland can be zoned around these areas. They say it will protect a lot of the city's food supply. We do have a number of requests in with the Minister for Planning, Sonia Kilkenny, who is unavailable to speak to you this week. But Emma Germano is the President of the Victorian Farmers Federation, can talk about this and a couple of other issues as well. Emma Germano, welcome back to the Country Hour.
G'day, Warwick.
Greater protection for farmland in Victoria, particularly close to the city, which is ever expanding every year. That's a good thing, isn't it?
This is the really interesting thing when you read all of the preamble to their action plan, which talks about how valuable agriculture is and how valuable the land is. And we say, well, hang on a second, why is it not Victoria-wide, which is what we've been asking for, like this kind of assessment of this strategic agricultural land across the state. You know, all of the sentiments as to how much the government apparently appreciates farming and agricultural land, you know, it'd be nice if we felt like they felt that every single day of the week. And why 100 kilometres from Melbourne, people say, oh, it's because of the urban growth and that we need to think about protecting this land. But there are a lot of farmers who are trying in earnest to farm within these zones that are, in some cases, I think the ship has already sailed and it's already become too difficult. And this report is really, I guess, you know, appeasing a couple of universities and some groups that think that it's really romantic and pretty to be able to see production of food right up against, you know, Melbourne's fringe. So, yeah, it's very confusing. It's you know, this is their second round of trying to get this thing right. And I don't know, it's, a lot of it seems very arbitrary to me.
How much farmland in these areas is actively being farmed? Of course, there are intensive areas like Werribee, which is still producing quite a lot of food, Bacchus Marsh, etc. But there is, just driving in on the Hume Highway, driving, if you're coming in from Gippsland, you see it as well. If you go down the Mornington Peninsula, you see it. There is a lot of farmland that isn't actively being farmed, and the accusation would be it's been land banked by developers who were looking for a change in zoning.
Yeah, and that also creates an issue for some of the farmers in those areas who have been maybe anticipating that the land would rezone and that would be an exit strategy for them. We've seen some people within those zones who have sold up their farms where it has been, you know, eventually rezoned, and they've gone out and done a farm bigger somewhere else where, you know, you don't have as many issues trying to farm, you know, next door to a primary school, for example. So to suggest that this is going to help with food security or that it's fraught with a lot of issues. I actually caught up with a friend yesterday who has some land north of the city. He's on 40 hectares, and he literally is mowing the lawn instead of having any livestock on it because it's a nice lifestyle block. So I think that there's probably, it's all been oversimplified, and like I said, it becomes really arbitrary, and it actually makes it more confusing for a lot of farmers in those zones. If you think about Werribee, we've got a real issue with the water supply there, and and the quality of the water there. And these farmers are paying exorbitant amounts to keep the system, the irrigation system, running. And in fact, what they're doing is compensating or subsidising the houses that are in that same area. And the cynic in me says, well, does the government insist that Werribee South farmers have to continue farming just to make sure that the people in the Wyndham Harbour actually have water being delivered to their houses? So many issues with this, and kind of a failure to acknowledge that what we really need to consider is the kind of land use conflict and be providing those councils that are making these decisions with the guidelines that are necessary to understand what happens in agriculture and why it's not fair that if you've had a broiler farm in a particular area for the last 50 years that all of a sudden the house is moving next door and now you've got to apply for a permit to run an irrigation pump or, you know, run a new piece of technology on the basis that the town folk beside you don't like it. So there's all of this conflict, and I don't think their little action plan is going to assist with any of it.
Which comes to the next question, really. How do you design a better system? How could you make something like this work better?
So we're saying straight up, you need to actually have that that lens across all of the agricultural land in Victoria, because what's the difference between whether or not we've got urban boundary pressure in Melbourne compared to in Bendigo or Ballarat or any of the other major town centres in the rest of Victoria? It also seemed, you know, a bit ironic to me that we're talking about how we've got to protect this land, but this is the exact argument that the VFF's been saying to the government in regards to renewable energy facilities and transmission. You've got to protect this land. You've got to be strategic about where you do infrastructure. And yet, you know, that's like, you know, knocking your head against a brick wall, trying to get them to understand that. But again, back to this romantic notion around Melbourne and what we like to see and what makes us feel good, we'll come up with an action plan to protect that. And we're saying we need to have really specific and clear guidance to all of the Shire councils when they're making these decisions about land use conflict and how to go about making good decisions so that you can, you know, sometimes have both. And in some areas, you're not going to be able to have both. You need to just maintain it for agriculture. And again, why is this only about the green wedge instead of actually looking at the rural zone as well?
And just before we move on, you talk about your frustrations around renewable energy, but that is even a carve-out in these laws here. The government says it can make decisions to build infrastructure like roads, like renewable energy or transmission lines to renewable energy as part of its reasons to build on farmland, even in the green zone, even under these protections.
Yeah, it simply looks like the government says, well, we want to restrict what you're allowed to do in the green wedge so that we can say that we're protecting agricultural land, unless it's us who want to make the decision about what we put in that on that agricultural land. You know, if you really cared about your 100-kilometre radius and how important this land is to Melbourne, then, you know, you probably wouldn't have been dumping toxic soil in Bacchus Marsh and that sort of thing. You've got farms that have got roundabouts going through gas. We've got one member of the VFF who's got a gas line, he's got transmission lines, he's across the road from a transfer station. For him to farm has become just about impossible. They'll keep dumping more and more infrastructure on his property and say that it's compulsory acquisition or compulsory easements, but they're not really considering how difficult it becomes to actually farm in those places. So again, we've just got to be strategic about what we're doing, where we're doing it, and how we're doing it. So all of the sentiments at the beginning of their report are really nice. I just wish they felt like that about agriculture across the whole state.
Just before we go, Emma Germano's with you, the president of the Victorian Farmers Federation. You've been writing to supermarkets. Why?
I really think that what we need to be talking about with the supermarkets, this whole supermarket debate is actually really starting to concern me. There's kind of been no question that there's some practices that the supermarkets do in regards to how they buy their fresh produce, and being across the board, livestock and dairy and whatever else. We know that it's been problematic. That's not a new problem. All of a sudden, we've got a government who has a cost of living crisis, really. The pressure is starting to bite. This is so political because it was used initially as a smokescreen by the government saying, oh, everybody look over there. It's the supermarket's fault that everything's so expensive. And now we've seen the chiming in of the National Party, who when the National Party starts working with the Greens, you've got to start asking questions about the politics. Apparently we're going to have all these different bills that everybody is going to suggest in regards to divestiture power, which, I mean, where do you stop once you say that the supermarkets have got a set price for food? I mean, are they going to be coming to the farm gate and saying that, you know, we're only allowed to grow a certain percentage percentage of Australia's cauliflowers and here's a set price for us, and then are they going to go to our fertiliser companies and do the same thing there? I mean, you know, we're hiding behind supermarkets. Now, that does not, I'm not saying for a second that we don't have issues with the supermarkets, but for it to be playing out like this and to say the cost of food is too expensive in the supermarket, does that not say when you, when most people know that in one of those major supermarkets you can buy the cheaper, you know, your shopping basket ends up cheaper, is that not to say that everybody whose prices are more expensive are price gouging? Like, there's no definition for that word. So I think that part of the solution is getting those supermarkets to realise if they cared about agricultural sustainability in Australia and sourcing from Australia, then they would treat that the way that they're treating their ethical sourcing policies, the way that they're treating their climate resilience and reduction of emissions, their recycling stuff. They've got all of this ESG requirement that they acknowledge as supermarket boards. And if we could just slide agricultural sustainability into that and profitability, then we would see some different outcomes, I think, because ultimately...
So you want them to report on how they treat farmers?
Yeah, I think that that would be really helpful and for them to acknowledge and have some real measures around that, because otherwise the measures are... how much of a markup did the buyer make on the apples this week? And that's how they're rewarded. So you have to have the sentiment throughout the entire business that we care about farmers and we care about the ongoing food supply. It's been quite amazing over the last 3 weeks, some of the complaints that I've had from producers who were, you know, the supermarkets seem to have hit the accelerator on some of their unfair practices and seem to be unperturbed by what's going on with these, you know, inquiries and all of the flack that's been, you know, thrown at them.
So those things, those practices are continuing even under the guise of all these inquiries. Emma Jemana, we're out of time. You let us know if they take you up on the meeting.
Let's keep talking about supermarkets. Yeah. I will.
Thanks, Emma Jemana there, President of the Victorian Farmers Federation, speaking to you on the Country Hour. Right now, though, let's get some rural news with Emma Field. Hi, Emma.
G'day, Warwick. More than 100 Australian cattle have died on a live export shipment to Indonesia. A spokesperson for the Department of Agriculture told the ABC it was notified by a commercial exporter of the cattle deaths on a live export vessel heading to Indonesia. Prior to departure, the department says it undertook pre-export inspections to ensure the livestock met requirements under the Export Control Act and importing country requirements. The statement goes on to say there was no suggestion an exotic animal disease was involved and they are investigating as a matter of priority. Australia remains free of exotic animal diseases such as lumpy skin disease and foot and mouth disease. Industry group the Australian Livestock Exporters Council has suggested botulism, a rare disease spread via bacteria, could be the cause of the cattle deaths. ALEC Chief Executive Mark Harvey-Sutton confirmed the livestock shipment was discharged in Indonesia on March the 24th.
On board that vessel, a significant number of animals became sick. The initial thoughts are that it is actually botulism, but that is all to be confirmed. And the Department of Agriculture is conducting its investigation now to confirm that, which will include testing and treating cattle as necessary. The exporter is working very closely with the department at the moment. We'll learn more over time.
Would this be the largest report of mortality on a cattle shipment from Australia that you can recall?
In my recollection, yes, it would. But it does seem that there were some extraordinary circumstances that have seen this event take place.
And here's one for agriculture and mining commodity traders. A tonne of cocoa now costs more than copper. Just in time for Easter, the price of chocolate has shot up and overtaken what was once the high-priced metal in the market. Cocoa is trading at $10,406 a tonne, while copper is trading at $8,743 a tonne. It's a remarkable turnaround from January 2022, when cocoa was around $2,000 and copper was around $10,000 a tonne. And it just goes to show, even the Easter Bunny is not immune from rising import costs. And Australia's largest cattle company is celebrating its 200th birthday this week. Australian Agricultural Company, better known as AACo, was started back in 1824. And from humble beginnings running sheep in New South Wales, the company now runs a cattle herd of around 430,000 head across 6.5 million hectares. CEO David Harris says the company has come a long way.
They started with a board meeting of a few people in London in about April back in 1824. Then was an Act of Parliament that actually established the company in about June, July of that year. Then in November of 1824, there was a royal charter signed. The first animals and people kind of didn't hit the shores of Australia till late kind of 25. They showed up on the shores with sort of 700 odd sheep, 15 odd cattle and 12 horses down near Stroud, actually. So just north of Sydney there on the coast, largely they were actually looking for sheep country. So that was an interesting spot. Which didn't work out for them, but they kind of worked out that wasn't right and started moving north.
The Angus breed has been crowned Supreme Beef Breed Champion at the Sydney Royal Easter Show for 2024. The prestigious Horden and Urquhart Gong was awarded to first-time winners, Donna, Jack and Sam Robson from southern New South Wales. Donna Robson says it's a big win after a lifetime of showing cattle at the Sydney Royal.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Supreme Beef Breed Championship, the Horden Perpetual Trophy, goes to the Angus breed.
Donna Robson, and we're based at Adelong in southern New South Wales. I think with this cow and calf, it's just that she's a complete package. Like, she's a pretty impressive animal in her own right, and then she's got a pretty impressive calf beside her.
So is this a first for you, winning Supreme Exhibit?
Yes, it is, yeah. Yeah, yep.
That must be amazing.
It is, when you've been coming here for so long and just, turn up every year and keep competing and, just shows that you just got to stick with it and, keep coming back.
And you won't believe what one sheep went through this week was giving birth to six lambs. A crossbred Merino ewe at Corinne in South Australia's southeast this week gave birth to sextuplets. Yes, six lambs in one go. Hobby farmer owner Brad Shepherd says it was a very unexpected discovery.
My partner came inside and said, "Oh, we've got lambs. We've been waiting. The lambs, the ewes are all about due." And I walked out and obviously to my shock, saw six of them sprawled out across the ground. Unfortunately, one died at birth, but the other five are all doing quite well at the moment. I went round straight away and checked the other ewes. Then none of them had sunken hips. They're all quite full. And the mother, as you can imagine, was quite exhausted. She was laying on the ground for most of yesterday, but we've been tending to her and she's come back quite well now.
And that is an early nomination for Mother of the Year, was. And that wraps up Rural News.
Well, got my vote. Sextuplets. I don't know if you've had anything like that on the farm. Remember, you can always let us know. Send us a text 0467 842 722. A couple of your texts. Warwick, once caged poultry is banned in this country, we'll have widespread bird flu throughout the poultry industry. And given this revelation about the dairy cattle in the US, it may mean the destruction of more agricultural livestock industries too, says one text. Inquiry into welfare of pigs in Victoria by government. Who's going to do an inquiry over human welfare, especially during COVID, says a text. Melbourne sprawl is doing far more environmental damage to our state. Melbourne has to go up, not out, says Wally. Well, that's sort of the thought behind one of that Green Wedge legislation from the government. It's just, is it going to land in the right way? That is the interesting point. And oh no, Woz, how does one eat a copper Easter egg, says Nigel from Vespa. On the big news that copper is now cheaper per tonne than cocoa. Yes, cocoa. Very expensive right now. So hot in the market, the Easter Bunny must have been doing a lot of buying up in that marketplace. Bri McPherson has your weather details for you, senior forecaster at the Bureau. Hi, Bri.
Hi, how are you going?
Yeah, good. How's it looking around Victoria today and heading into Easter?
Yeah, look, a bit of a cooler southerly flow over the state today, so fine and sunny in the north. Bit of smoke around from some of the plan burns that the fire agencies have been busy working on. In the south, some cloud and the odd isolated shower around, but really not much in the way of rainfall in the gauges, just a mill or two in a couple of locations, and not expecting an awful lot more than that. And fairly cool temperatures over the state today, so really only getting into the mid-high 20s in the north and the low 20s in the south. And fairly similar conditions tomorrow as well, because we're still in a southerly flow as the high-pressure system moves across the Bight towards us, though we might see those showers in the south ease off a little bit more later in the afternoon tomorrow. And then for the start of the long weekend, things are warming up a little bit. Winds turn more northerly, but not too strong, so fairly light winds still. There'll be plenty of smoke around the state over the long weekend with the the planned burns going on in full force. But it should be a mostly sunny and dry day on Friday, with those temperatures warming up a little bit on Friday. And similarly on Saturday, mostly dry and sunny, getting a little bit warmer again, so hot in the north and warm in the south. But unfortunately then, that is where our certainty ends.
Oh, okay. Why is it so uncertain after that?
Tropical moisture.
that old chestnut.
Yeah, tropical moisture and lows in the upper atmosphere. So, yeah, so there's some tropical moisture that's been brought down over central parts of Australia at the moment. And at some point during the second half of the long weekend or into the middle part of next week, we might see that come over us, but there is a chance it'll just stay to the north and more be an issue for places like New South Wales. So a lot of uncertainty in our models at the moment. So from Sunday, one of our models is bringing a cooler southerly change, but fairly settled conditions over the state, so we just end up back in these southerlies with the cloud and showers on the south side of the ranges pretty much all through next week. But the other alternative that's showing up in some of the other models is quite different, and it actually brings that tropical moisture down over Victoria starting from sort of later on Sunday, but more likely Monday and particularly Tuesday before it clears it off into the Tasman Sea during Wednesday. And that brings a fair bit more rainfall with it, that scenario. So quite a big difference in the models that we're looking at. Either solution is valid at this point, but we couldn't give you too much certainty as to which way it goes.
Oh, well, that makes it tough going into a long weekend, right?
It does. I mean, it's as far as the rainfall goes, look, it should be happening later in your weekend, so more likely Monday. But, yeah, I guess it's for anyone out there that's looking for a decent amount of rainfall. Some of our models are showing pretty much nothing in the north, and then other ones are showing sort of particularly in the northeast, sort of around that 15 to 30 mils. So, yeah, you can see there's a big difference and big range of impacts potentially, depending on which way we end up going. And hopefully over the next day or so, we'll get a little bit more clarity on that and people can plan their weekends and next week a little bit better.
And we are on radio tomorrow, not on Good Friday, though. So anyone listening out, there won't be a Country Hour Good Friday. I'm sure there'll be a weather report that someone will give, but not the local bureau for you if you're listening out for that. So you're telling me there's a chance, Brian. Tomorrow we might have some more details.
Oh, hopefully, yes. Hopefully they start to agree with each other, these models, and hopefully it goes whichever way that everyone wants it to go.
Well played. Any warnings we need to be aware of or that are likely in the next couple of days?
No, nothing on the horizon. Yeah.
Well, Bright, thanks very much for the update.
Not a problem.
Brian McPherson there, Senior Forecaster at the Weather Bureau, taking you through the full details, well, what we know, and the unknown unknowns and the known unknowns with the weather forecast, because it sounds like there's a fair bit going on. It is 18 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Plenty of your texts coming in. I'll get to those in a moment. I want to take you near Portland now, where there's anger that the state government has approved an abalone farm the size of about 10 MCGs. Laura Mayers is an ABC reporter, can tell you more on this and can join you right now. Hi, Laura. Welcome back to the Country Hour.
Good afternoon.
What can you tell me? Where is this farm going to be built and why are people against it?
It's an interesting one that's been happening for quite a long time, nearly 6 years now, that we've seen residents down in Dutton Way, it's called. It's a little area near Portland that have been fighting this 45.5-hectare long Portland abalone farm. So this week, earlier this week, Victoria's Department of Transport and Planning wrote to the operator and just let the residents know as well, which confirmed an approval of amendments to a planning scheme, which will basically enable the abalone farm to now move to the detailed design phase. So it's sort of the next step. There's a couple of reasons why people have voiced concerns. It's pretty important to note that those residents who have been fighting this proposal have said that they're not against the proposal at all. They think it's going to be an incredible economic boost for the region. However, they think the placement is inappropriate. It's rather lengthy, and it's right in front of it's on the coast. You know, it's next to beach access, really. So in 2020, previously, the Victorian Civil Administrative Tribunal rejected the operator Yumba Aquaculture. Their proposal for this. After it was rejected, they were able to put forward an amended plan to Planning Panels Victoria, which went to a pretty lengthy hearing again. And then that advised amended plan is now what has kind of had this green light. So it's looking at 500 tonnes of frozen and fresh abalone per year it's going to be producing. So fairly large. There are some things that they've kind of trying to do to alleviate some of those concerns about sort of visual impact, including creating buffer zones and that kind of thing. But unfortunately, you know, those residents are saying it's sort of not good enough. They have been fighting against this proposal, as I said, for nearly 6 years now. So they're really concerned. People today have said that they're, you know, shattered, disappointed, devastated. Those are a couple of the adjectives they used. But they did say...
So is it essentially approved now? Does that mean this will go ahead?
It will go ahead. The only reason it sort of wouldn't is that the company is obliged to complete the design within 2 years, and then they're expected to have it fully operational by 2029. If they don't complete the detailed design within 2 years, then, you know, that will kind of go back to the drawing board and we'll see what happens there. But that seems unlikely. We've been speaking to the CFO today who indicated that they do believe they'll have it up and running by 2029.
What's their reaction been to the approval in general, the company?
Well, they're very pleased. You know, this is something that they have been really pushing for, and they have been taking considerations for a while. They've said to us today that they expect it to be a huge economic boost for the region, you know, where they're expected to see plenty of jobs that are going to be born from this. So they are quite pleased. But I do believe that those residents are sort of taking stock at the moment to see if there's something that they can do further if they're going to continue that fight.
That's the next question. Do they have options in terms of continuing to fight a planning approval for an abalone farm?
That's sort of unclear at this stage. It doesn't really appear to be so, but I guess that will kind of be made clearer as we go back to the state government. I was speaking this morning to a resident, Leslie Yule, who lives out that way, and she kind of said, you know, they are really disappointed that despite the fact that it was initially rejected by VCAT, it was able to go ahead. And here's what Leslie actually had to say this morning.
How do I feel? I think the same as everybody does. Shattered, disappointed, devastated. It's been a 5.5 year battle. It's been knocked back by VCAT over a very long process, and it should be held in pretty high concern by everyone for the simple reason that anybody who has land that the government or that a private enterprise would like to acquire for whatever reasons can just go to the planning department and have this overlay put on it, totally contravenes what is right for down there.
So quite critical of that planning process, and I guess we'll see what the government has to say in response to that later today.
And this is a farmed operation. It's on land, and I don't know if you have an answer to this at all. Laura Mays is our reporter speaking to you about the abalone farm approval near Portland. But there has been an abalone killing disease, viral ganglioneuritis, off the coast of that region in the last year or so. Are there any concerns about that disease and if it puts any of the operation of an abalone farm at risk?
It doesn't appear so. I mean, that's something that we can certainly put to Yumba Aquaculture. From looking at the planning sort of overlays, it's looking like they're going to be put together in grow tanks. But as I said, yes, it is right off the coast there. So you do have to wonder if that's going to have an impact at all in the future. But that is a long way down the road, certainly, from when it's fully operational.
We'll have to watch it from here. Laura Mays, though, thanks for giving us these details.
Thanks, Woz.
That is ABC reporter Laura Mays telling you about this abalone farm approval near Portland. It's the size of 10 MCGs and is to be built at Dutton Way near Portland there. 0467 842 722 if you'd like to send us a text. Hey, some breaking news too. You heard about this in Rural News. We can give you some more details on it now. The Federal Department of Agriculture continues to investigate the deaths of more than 100 Australian cattle on board the ship Brahman Express that sailed to Indonesia earlier this month. It won't confirm how many cattle have died. Industry groups say the cattle came from one property in the Northern Territory, and it's assumed the toxin botulism is causing the cattle deaths. Australia's chief vet, Beth Cookson, is explaining here how botulism presents in livestock and what it could possibly mean for this livestock ship.
The cattle that died on board the vessel were not showing any signs that would make us suspect a disease like foot and mouth disease or lumpy skin disease. As a part of the investigation into the cause of the mortalities on the vessel, the department has been working closely with the exporter and the Northern Territory government to understand why that disease, why the mortality event has occurred. That has included sending veterinary officers to the registered establishment that prepared the cattle, and it has been identified that a number of cattle has also died within that facility. So we know that the signs that are being expressed are consistent with botulism.
Yeah, the industry suggested that botulism could be the cause or was the number one suspect, I suppose. How prevalent or how common is it that you would have mortality rates on a live export ship caused by botulism?
Well, botulism is a common bacteria globally, including in Australia. It's only under very specific environmental conditions that the bacteria starts to generate a toxin that essentially when eaten or is contaminating water creates this condition in cattle. And so what we suspect has occurred is that the exposure occurred prior to export and that the cattle, when they were inspected for export were not showing any clinical signs of disease, but that disease developed once they were on the livestock voyage.
What's the incubation period?
The incubation period can be up to 17 days after exposure. Often it's more quick than that. But what we do find is once the incubation period has completed and the animals have been infected by the toxin, that the rapid onset occurs and the animals then die quite quickly after that.
So it is fatal in cattle?
Usually it's fatal. We would say that more often than not, animals that have been infected will die of the toxin. There is no specific treatment for botulism once the animals have been exposed to the toxin. Some animals may recover through supportive therapy by making sure that they've got food and water and shade, but that's not the usual that's not the usual outcome.
But there is a vaccine that could potentially prevent botulism in cattle, is that right?
Yes, there is a vaccine that can be used in cattle and is commonly used in Australian cattle. That's why we don't regularly see mortalities at this scale.
And just to be clear, because I understand humans can contract a form of botulism too, but what we're talking about here in the livestock is quite a separate disease, and that if humans are handling infected livestock, it's highly unlikely that they will in fact be infected or sick. Is that right?
There are a number of different types of botulinum toxins, and people are not usually susceptible to the ones that affect cattle. What I would be saying is that meat from clinically normal animals in herds affected by a botulism outbreak is safe for human consumption.
And when will we know, when is it likely that the department will be able to confirm this suspected botulism or otherwise?
The investigation is ongoing. Botulism is usually diagnosed by veterinarians through the way that the disease is expressed, the clinical signs on the ground, as well as excluding a range of other potential causes.
That's Australia's Chief Veterinary Officer, Beth Cookson, speaking there to Kath Sullivan here on the Country Hour. And when we know more, we'll bring it to you on the program. Let's finish today with something a little bit different, and it's all the way in WA. I was going to bring you some stories from VicGrid in Gippsland, and also a change possibly to the V&I route as well. I will hold them to tomorrow because we've run out of time with that breaking news today. So let's go to WA, where the Country Women's Association in Western Australia is thinking about opening its doors to men. The CWA in Western Australia is celebrating 100 years of service in July, and to mark the milestone, some branches are reflecting on past achievements and looking to the future. And if that future involves fellas, Kate Forrester headed along to the CWA event in Pemberton in the state's southwest for a cuppa and a scone.
I use 3 cups of flour and a cup of cream and a cup of lemonade, actually.
I'm about to get a rundown on how to make the perfect scone.
Then roll it out, don't knead it, otherwise it makes them hard.
I'm in Pemberton for the CWA Centenary Celebration. A morning tea open to all, with many of the members who are a part of the women-only branch in attendance.
I'm from Thailand. I live here 5 years. Yes, and when I first moved here, my accent and my English wasn't this good. And my husband say, you should hang out with Australian women.
40-year-old Tita Baldock is one of the youngest members of the local branch, finding a sense of purpose and belonging in the organisation.
It's a, how can I say, sisterhood? Like, how can I say? It's like a group of lovely ladies that helping each other and always laugh and always, you know, tell stories. And I learn a lot from them as well.
What are some of those things you've learnt?
What is the best wine?
It's a similar experience for 101-year-old Rachel Mitchell, who was recently made a life member just down the road at the Donnybrook CWA. She loves to think back to what it was like when she first joined.
Oh, yes, you always wore your stockings and your gloves and your hat, and that was part of being dressed up in those days. It certainly wasn't as casual as it is these days. I'd lost my husband and I was looking for more interest in town, I suppose.
For someone like Rachel, she's seen a lot of change happen over the past century. But what is the next 100 years going to look like for this organisation?
Whether we'll get little aeroplanes to fly here and there, I don't know.
I get the idea that the CWA State Chief Executive, Trish Langdon, senses a bit of change in the air.
An organisation has to remain compliant with the current laws. So that's one of the major drivers of this. The second thing is to make sure that the organisation is governed in a contemporary manner. So we're changing some of that.
Trish Langdon is speaking there about their CWA State Conference, which is coming up in July. There's going to be some big points of discussion on the table.
We're considering having associate members, males as associate members. We have had a long history of men contributing to the CWA right from the word go, with members, they were either forced into helping keep buildings maintained or grass clipped or whatever.
Do you think there's mixed emotions about that, Trish, from members?
I think there are some members who say, you know, they think it's very important to keep it as a women's only organisation.
Back at the Pemberton morning tea, President Pat Nock is a little uncertain about the idea of men joining.
That's a bit hard one. Like I said, if they bring it in, well, they'll bring it in. We'll have to abide by the rules. But like I said, personally, I think it's nice for ladies to have somewhere to go to get away from the men, and the same as men get away from the ladies and have their own things. I know it's a modern thing that everybody should integrate, but I'm old-fashioned and think that we do need to have our own space.
To use the term that you used, old-fashioned, being old-fashioned, is that going to allow the CWA to keep going?
I think so. I think there's a place for everybody. I'm old-fashioned in that I refuse to go on the internet. I refuse to have a computer. I'm also, if we get men in, I'll welcome them in. There'll be no, there's no animal. I won't leave because, oh gosh, men are in, I'm out. None of that. No, I'm not anti-men at all. But, I just like the CWA the way it is.
That is a report from Kate Forrester, who sounds like she was having way too much fun at the CWA meeting in Pemberton in Western Australia. I think we're going to hear a lot more about that, and you can read more about it at ABC Rural Online. That's it for us today. I'll catch you again tomorrow. It's 1 o'clock.